This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion of any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained here, including any attachment, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. At this time, I would like to turn today's program over to Mr. Bob Stevens. Bob, you may begin.
Thank you very much. My name is Bob Stevens. I'm a partner in the Trade Secret Practice Group of Seyfarth Shaw. I want to welcome you to the sixth installment of the Seyfarth Shaw 2013 Trade Secret Webinar Series. The focus of today's presentation is a legislative update of non-compete, trade secret, and social media laws. The webinar will be available shortly after this presentation today on our blog at www.tradesecretslaw.com as a podcast. We will also have CLE credit available, and the code for that will be provided during the course of this presentation today. As part of the presentation, we will have two additional presenters, Dan Hart and Eric Weibust. And Dan will speak on legislative developments in non-compete and restrictive covenants, and Eric will speak on legislative developments in trade secret law. At the conclusion, I will give a brief update on legislative updates in social media. So without further ado, I'll hand it over to Dan Hart to begin our presentation.
Well, thank you, Bob. Good afternoon from the East Coast, and good morning to those who are joining us from the West Coast. In our blog, every year we report on a number of proposed bills that are introduced in state legislatures throughout the country to reform the existing law on non-competes and other restrictive covenants. And it's not surprising that state legislatures seem to continually revisit this issue year after year. Restrictive covenants are solely the province of state law, and in many states they are solely the province of common law. And so every year we see efforts in some states to enact legislation to either codify or revise the existing common law, either to make the restricted covenants either more easily enforceable against employees or less easily enforceable against employees, depending on how the common law of that state has developed and the individual state's public policies. Most of these proposals never get enacted, but every year there's always a few that do. And this past year has been no different in that regard. Today we can report on some breaking news out of Connecticut. And if you'll just bear with us for a minute while we adjust the slide here. We can report that yesterday, Governor Dan Malloy signed into law H.R. 6658, which was approved by both chambers of Connecticut's legislature earlier this month. The new law, which is titled An Act Concerning Employer Use of Non-Compete Agreements, goes into effect on October 1st of this year, and it applies to any non-compete agreements entered into on or after that date. The law does not have retroactive effect. And what this law does is that it provides that any non-compete agreements between an employer and employee that are made, renewed, or extended on or after October 1st of 2013 are void unless, before entering into the agreement, the employer provides the employee with a written copy of the agreement and at least 7 days to consider the merits of entering into the agreement. The law also provides that an employee can waive his or her rights under the agreement if the waiver is set forth in a separate writing, it sets forth the right being waived, and it's signed by the employee prior to entering into the agreement. Before this law was enacted, we reported on an earlier draft of the bill. in our blog. And it should be noted that the final version of the bill that was signed by Governor Malloy yesterday is substantially watered down from the prior draft that we reported on. And first and most significantly, the law has a very important caveat. It applies only when an employer is acquired by or merges with another employer, and as a result of the acquisition or merger, an employee's continued employment is conditioned on the employee entering into a non-compete agreement, which is not defined in the bill. The earlier draft of the bill attempted a much more comprehensive regulation of non-competes. Apparently, the earlier draft encountered political resistance, and so this narrower bill was all that could be enacted this legislative term. It would not be surprising if the original bill sponsors continue to introduce legislation providing for more sweeping regulation of non-competes in the future. And so we'll certainly keep our eyes tuned to that or ears tuned to that and report on that as there are more developments in the next year. A second important limitation in this bill from the earlier versions is that the earlier draft of the bill would have provided employees with a statutory basis for filing suit against employers who act in violation of the law. And this would have included recovery of damages and attorney's fees. The final bill lacks this provision. And so there is not a private right of action in Connecticut under the new law as was anticipated by the prior draft. And third, a prior draft of the bill would have required employers to provide employees with, quote, at least 10 days and more, if reasonable, to consider the merits of entering into the agreement. The final bill dropped the number from 10 to 7 days and omitted this vague, more if reasonable language. So despite the fact that this law is watered down from its prior versions, it still is a significant piece of legislation that will impact potentially all employers who have operations in Connecticut. Significantly, this marks the first time that Connecticut has passed a generally applicable statute regarding employee non-competes. Connecticut is one of those states that governs non-competes primarily by common law, and previously existing statutes in Connecticut do cover employees who are broadcasters, and there's another statute that covers employees who are security guards. But this is the first time that Connecticut has passed a statute on this topic that covers all employees in all industries. We'll see how the courts interpret this statute, but going forward, employees in Connecticut should include non-competes in any M&A due diligence to ensure that employees are provided with the proper notice before the deal closes and before the employees of the acquired entity are hired as employees by the acquiring entity. Moving from Connecticut to another state in the Northeast, the New Jersey Assembly is currently considering Bill A-3970. And this bill is similar to proposed legislation in Maryland, which we'll discuss a little bit later this afternoon. And it's intended to prevent employers from enforcing restrictive covenants against employees who can claim unemployment benefits. Currently, restrictive covenants are a matter of common law in New Jersey, like many other states, and employers can enforce restrictive covenants in New Jersey against former employees if they can show that the agreement meets a three-pronged test of reasonableness. Former employees are free to argue that they are unemployed and that enforcement of a non-compete against them would be unreasonable under the circumstances, and it's a factor to be considered by the courts. But the mere fact that they are unemployed is not dispositive under the current common law rule. This bill, if enacted, would make a substantial change in the law in New Jersey in that it would automatically invalidate contracts or agreements not to compete, not to disclose, or not to solicit in cases where the individuals who are bound by the agreements qualify for unemployment benefits. The bill's chances of getting passed are unclear. And we expect that the bill will encounter substantial resistance from the business community in New Jersey. One objection that's been raised is that the bill could end up rewarding employees who have been terminated for bad behavior. The standard for showing entitlement to unemployment compensation is fairly low, unlike the standard for recovering damages for a wrongful termination under statute or common law. Employees who have been discharged are presumed to be entitled to benefits, and the burden is on the employer to demonstrate that the former employee is disqualified. Now, there could be situations in light of that burden on the employer where an employee has been discharged for misconduct and yet is still able to obtain unemployment benefits because the employer can't show disqualification. And in that situation, under this bill, an employee who has been discharged for misconduct would have the advantage of being able to get out of a non-compete agreement to which he or she otherwise would be subject. Another objection that's been voiced to this bill is that it's not clear if the bill really will accomplish what it sets out to do. It's not surprising to see why the sponsors of this bill have brought it forward. New Jersey has a fairly high unemployment rate. I think it's about 9.3% right now. And so presumably the sponsors of this bill think that by passing this bill, they will be able to reduce the level of unemployment in the state. You know, that assumption there really depends on whether there is a correlation between individuals who are unemployed and the relative ease of enforcing non-compete agreements in New Jersey under the current legal regime. It's not clear that there is such a correlation. It's not clear, for example, that the vast bulk of people who are unemployed are encountering hindrance in getting additional or new gainful employment because they're bound by a restrictive covenant. In addition, the bill could have unintended consequences, as some have argued, because this bill, if enacted, would eliminate an employer's ability to enforce a non-compete agreement against former employees. It's certainly possible that employers in New Jersey will fight harder to win unemployment claims than they are right now, which ultimately would have a consequence that was not intended by the authors of the bill. And so for all these reasons, it's going to be interesting to see how this bill shakes out in New Jersey. We'll continue to report developments on this bill on our blog. And in the meantime, if you have operations in New Jersey, it certainly would be prudent to continue to monitor this to see how this will impact your operations, if at all. Well, staying with the Northeast, we'll move from the Garden State to the Bay State. And if you follow our blog or other news outlets on non-competes, you may have seen that proposed non-compete legislation is introduced just about every year in Massachusetts, but it has yet to gain significant traction. Currently, Massachusetts law on restricted covenants is governed by common law, and under the common law rule as developed by the courts there, restrictive covenants can be enforced if they meet a common law rule of reasonableness. Past legislative proposals have tried to make restrictive covenants more difficult to enforce in Massachusetts. And in fact, there was a past bill that failed that would have made Massachusetts more like California in virtually outlawing almost all restrictive covenants. If you attended our legislative developments webinar last year, you may recall that we reported on a proposal in Massachusetts that would have substantially revised Massachusetts law on this issue. The bill that we reported on last year did not go anywhere, did not get passed. And so this year, the two legislators who have previously introduced legislation, and their Representative Ehrlich and Senator Brownsberger, have opted for a more modest approach than they've taken in past years in the hope that the more modest approach might have traction. And the proposed legislation, which is H-1715, is known as the Non-Compete Agreement Duration Act and would provide that, with some limited exceptions, any non-compete lasting longer than 6 months would be considered unreasonable and unenforceable in Massachusetts. The bill does provide three limited exceptions that would become the law if the bill is enacted. And under these exceptions, the six-month limit would not apply if the employee has breached his or her fiduciary duty, if the employee has unlawfully taken property belonging to the employer, and that would be either physical or electronic property, or if the employee has at any time received annualized tax taxable compensation from the employer of $250,000 or more. If a court determines that the duration of the non-compete agreement is unreasonable and one of these exceptions does not apply, the non-compete agreement will be unenforceable in its entirety. And this represents a big departure from existing law in Massachusetts, which permits the court to reform an unenforceable agreement to make it enforceable. As with the other proposed bills, we'll continue to track on developments with respect to this legislation. Last year, we reported on a new statute passed in New Hampshire just before our legislative developments webinar. And at risk of repeating what you might have heard last year, we want to briefly recap that statute as it does represent a fairly significant legislative development that has been in effect for less than a year. And that statute, which was HB 1270, was signed into law on May 15th of last year, but did not go into effect until July 14th of last year. And the entire text of the statute is quite short. It's only two sentences and reads as follows. Prior to or concurrent with making an offer of change in job classification or an offer of employment, every employer shall provide a copy of any non-compete or non-piracy agreement that is part of the employment agreement to the employee or potential employee. Any contract that is not in compliance with this section shall be void and unenforceable. Last year, we reported that this newly passed legislation raised a lot of questions that would need resolution by the courts. Unfortunately, there have not been any reported decisions on the statute since its passage last year, and so some of these uncertainties still remain. And the first uncertainty is that there's no definition of the term non-compete or non-piracy in the statute, and so it's unclear what precise restrictive covenants it applies to. Until the courts decide this issue, though, it would be prudent to assume that the statute applies to all true non-compete agreements as well as to any kind of employee or customer non-solicits, as well as potentially any non-disclosure covenants. And second, there's no definition of the term changes in job classification in the statute. So it's unclear exactly how broad it is. It would be prudent in the meantime to assume that it applies to any restrictive covenants that are tied to any change in employment, and that would include potentially promotions, demotions, lateral moves, changes in title or job position, and possibly even salary increases that don't result in any change in title or position change. Let's turn briefly to some other proposed legislation of note. Before we move on to trade secrets. In Illinois, Representative Thomas Morrison, who incidentally is a Republican in a heavily democratically controlled legislature, introduced a somewhat unique non-compete bill. And Representative Morrison's bill, which is HB 27082, known as the Employment Non-Compete Agreement Act, does some interesting things, or would do some interesting things if it's enacted. One of the most significant things it would do is essentially jettison the American rule on recovery of damages and instead adopt the English rule, at least in non-compete litigation, in that what it would do is require courts to award the prevailing party damages, costs and expenses, and reasonable attorney's fees in the event of a suit either to enforce a non-compete agreement or potentially a suit to declare it unenforceable. Another interesting thing about this bill is that it would require the maximum length of a post-employment restriction to have a comparable relationship to an employee's position and salary at the time of termination. The bill doesn't further specify anything about the position, and so, at least as currently drafted, it really would tie the length of a non-compete to the salary that an employee gets. And you can see from the slide how it's set out. If an employee gets a salary of less than $50,000, the maximum duration of a non-compete that an employer could have is 6 months. And that goes up progressively up to 18 months being the longest period of time that would be permitted for a non-compete for an employee who makes $150,000 or more. It's unclear how likely the bill is to pass. As I mentioned, the sponsor of the bill is in the minority party in the legislature, and it's not clear whether he would be able to garner sufficient interest in the bill, not just from those in his own party, but across the aisle. And the bill has been the subject of some criticism. One of the things the bill would do, if it's enacted, would set out expressly in the bill that employers have a legitimate commercial interest in being protected against competition and solicitation by former employees. Some have criticized the bill on the grounds that that idea, or that concept, is already well established in the common law of Illinois. There's not any need to have it set out in statutory law. Others have objected to this concept of providing a formula that would tie the length of a post-employment restriction to the amount of salary an employee gets. And that could go either way. Some have said that individuals who are paid lower salaries nonetheless should be subject to longer restricted covenants than 6 months or a year. Others have said that some employees who are highly compensated should not be automatically subject to a restriction of 18 months or more. And then still others have objected to the bill on the grounds that this fee-shifting provision really would result in a dramatic change in litigation in Illinois. So as with the other bills, we'll see where this goes and if there are any further developments. In the meantime, if you have operations in Illinois, this bill is something to keep on your radar. Just a few other states' proposals that are of note. Earlier this year, a bill was introduced in the Minnesota House of Representatives that would result in a very dramatic change in the law in Minnesota. Currently, Minnesota courts will enforce restrictive covenants if they are narrowly construed. If passed, the particular bill at issue would invalidate all non-compete agreements between employers and respective employees, and it would be effective the day following enactment. Essentially, Minnesota would become like California in having nearly across-the-board prohibition on employee restrictive covenants. And again, it's hard to say what's going to happen with this bill. There are some who have argued that if enacted, the changes brought about by this bill would be negative for business in Minnesota and would place the state out of the mainstream of U.S. non-compete law. At any rate, there's not going to be any further development on the bill this year as the legislature is adjourned until February of next year. But we'll see what happens in February, and as always, we'll keep apprised on developments. One final note should be made about some pending legislation in Maryland, which would do essentially the same thing as the proposed New Jersey legislation we talked about. In Maryland, there is a Senate bill which is pending right now, which, like the New Jersey legislation, would invalidate employee non-compete covenants for employees who applied for and obtained unemployment benefits. It should be noted that, unlike the New Jersey legislation, there are some potential loopholes in this legislation. It's not clear if it applies only to true non-competes or if it applies more broadly to restrictive covenants that would be customer non-solicits, employee non-solicits, et cetera. Typically, the state and federal courts in Maryland use the term restrictive covenant and non-competition covenant interchangeably. So it very well could be the case that this would impact any restrictive covenant at all, but the bill as currently drafted does not clarify that. And as with the New Jersey proposal, there's some uncertainty whether the bill would actually achieve what it set out to achieve, and we anticipate that there will be a fairly substantial amount of resistance to this bill from the business community in Maryland, as with the other proposed legislation. Again, we'll continue to track that and report it on our blog. Well, at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Eric to discuss recent developments in trade secret legislation.
Thank you, Dan. This is Eric Weibost up in Boston, and as Dan mentioned, I'll be discussing recent developments in trade secrets law since our last presentation this time last year. Currently, there is no federal civil cause of action for trade secrets misappropriation. So if a former employee or a competitor takes off with your trade secrets, you're going to have to go to state court unless you've got some other hook like diversity jurisdiction or a potential claim under the CFAA or the like. The problem with state court is that there's no nationwide service of process. Oftentimes, the entire legal process moves less efficiently and more slowly, and there are inconsistencies in the various state laws. In fact, even the definition of what constitutes a trade secret is not consistent across the United States, as a few states have not yet adopted the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, and those that have, they're not necessarily applying consistent definitions across the board. There is, however, a federal criminal trade secret statute, the Economic Espionage Act, or the EEA. As originally drafted, the EEA criminalizes two broad categories of trade secrets theft. Section 1831 deals with theft or misappropriation of trade secrets to benefit a foreign government or entity. And Section 1832 addresses theft or misappropriation of trade secrets that's related to a product involved in interstate or foreign commerce and benefits anyone who is not the owner. Now, though the media focus, especially of late, has been primarily on international economic espionage, or Section 1831, you'll often see articles about Chinese companies or the government or those in Russia stealing American companies' trade secrets. The vast majority of cases prosecuted under the Economic Espionage Act are actually brought under Section 1832, the domestic section. And they're oftentimes brought to prosecutors' attention by competitors, either to get an advantage in civil litigation or something like that. And in fact, I'm working on one of these cases right now where a competitor of our client filed suit years ago alleging theft of trade secrets. They brought their evidence of alleged misappropriation, as it were, to the prosecutors, to the United States Attorney's Office. United States Attorney's Office didn't do anything about it. The case litigated, has since resolved, and it's been over for several years now, but the U.S. Attorney is now looking into it and investigating it, ostensibly because this is now a hot topic that's in the media and that the government, as you'll see in the coming slides, is focused on. Another example of this competitors offering evidence to the government to get some sort of leverage or to further protect their interests is a case involving DuPont and its Kevlar trade secrets, and is a case pending currently in the Eastern District of Virginia called United States versus Cologne. And this is a criminal prosecution that follows a civil case in which a jury awarded DuPont more than $900 million and a 20-year injunction barring the defendant from manufacturing Kevlar. And again, the DuPont ostensibly brought that information to the government's attention. Now, the EEA... we're discussing the EEA in this presentation because it was recently amended in the last year, both to clarify what the scope of the act in response to a Second Circuit case that I'll address in a moment, and also to enhance the penalties available under the EEA. So the Second Circuit case I mentioned is called United States versus Alenikov. It was decided last year, and you may have read about this at the time. A few years ago, an employee of Goldman Sachs was convicted for stealing proprietary source code from Goldman's high-frequency trading program and was convicted under the Economic Espionage Act for that. The case went up on appeal, and the Second Circuit actually reversed the conviction, finding that Goldman's high-frequency trading system was neither produced for nor placed in interstate or foreign commerce. Goldman had no intention of selling its system or licensing it to anyone, and because the system was not designed to enter or pass into commerce or to make something that does, Alenikov's theft of source code relating to that system was not an offense under the EEA. It's a very technical decision based on the language of the EEA, but it did have big ramifications, including causing Congress to amend the EEA to clarify what it intended the scope of it to be. Specifically, in late 2012, Congress passed the Theft of Trade Secrets Clarification Act, and this was in direct response to the Alenikov case. And it clarifies that the EEA applies to trade secrets related to a product or service used or intended for use in interstate or foreign commerce. So now the EEA now protects a broader range of trade secrets, at least as compared to the Second Circuit's interpretation of what it previously protected. Also in late 2012, Congress passed the Foreign and Economic Espionage Penalty Enhancement Act of 2012. And this act increased fines for individuals from $500,000 to $5 million, and it increased corporate fines from $10 million to the greater of $10 million, or three times the value of the stolen trade secrets to the organization, which, if you know, talking about the DuPont case, where there were $900 million in damages awarded, this could reach into the billions. The act also, the Foreign Economic Espionage Penalty Enhancement Act, also directs the U.S. Sentencing Commission to review and amend the federal sentencing guidelines and policy statements applicable to offenses that are related to the transmission of stolen trade secrets or economic espionage in order to reflect the intent of Congress regarding the seriousness of such offenses. So although there is no, currently on the books, there is no trade secrets statute, civil statute, there is one that's pending in Congress right now called Protecting American Trade Secrets and Innovation Act of 2012, or PATSIA for short. This is a civil trade secrets statute. It was introduced by Senators Cole, Coons, and Whitehouse, all Democrats, and it's been referred to the Judiciary Committee. And essentially, it would provide a civil cause of action for American companies dealing with economic espionage and trade secrets theft to seek redress in federal court rather than having to file suit in individual state courts, which we discussed earlier, particularly is a problem if there's this type of theft is going on in more than one state. PATSIA also would have, if passed, a comparatively higher pleading standard, much more akin to a fraud claim, in that it would require a plaintiff asserting a claim under PATSIA to describe with specificity the reasonable measures taken to protect the secrecy of the alleged trade secrets in dispute, and also to include a sworn representation by the party asserting the claim that the dispute involves either substantial need for nationwide service of process or misappropriation of trade secrets from the United States to another country. Among other things, under PATSIA, if it's passed, plaintiffs would be permitted to bring a civil action in federal court for misappropriation of a trade secret that's related to or included in a product that is produced for or placed in interstate or foreign commerce. Of course, in federal court, you've got to have that interstate commerce hook, and the definition of that could potentially change based on the Alenikov case. That's yet to be seen. The Act does adopt a definition of misappropriation that's similar to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, but it doesn't actually define the term trade secrets, but both the EEA and the Uniform Trade Secrets Act define the term, and ostensibly it could be used for this as well. So the implications of PATSIA passing would be permit, of course, companies to file suit in federal court, which would give them nationwide service of process, subpoenas, discovery, witness depositions. You wouldn't have to go through the state court hurdles to take depositions in other states, for instance. It also would allow parties on an ex parte basis to seize property related to misappropriated trade secrets for up to 72 hours, and it would provide remedies in the form of injunctive relief, monetary damages, and any other affirmative actions necessary to protect a trade secret. So in addition to the EEA's amendments and PATSIA, the White House actually came out with a plan this year that has 5 points, and it's intended to combat American trade secrets theft. It was a collaboration between the Departments of Commerce, Defense, Homeland Security, Justice, State, Treasury, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. And the 5 main points are listed on the screen, and I'll go through each of them very briefly, one by one. But these are the points that the White House is placing emphasis on in terms of protecting trade secrets and what they intend to do to assist with that process. As far as diplomatic efforts go, under the terms of this plan, the State Department will take advantage of diplomatic meetings between countries in order to provide a platform to stress the importance of preventing theft of trade secrets. And the plan would also increase international engagement, especially with countries that pose a significant threat of theft of state trade secrets from American companies. As far as industry best practices go, in conjunction with the U.S. Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator, the administration plans to assist private companies in developing industry best practices to protect against trade secrets theft. This would include best practices in terms of research and development, human resources, and information and physical security policies. Domestic law enforcement opportunities, under this prong of the plan, both the FBI and the Department of Justice will continue to prioritize the investigation and prosecution of corporate and state-sponsored trade secrets theft. And potential new legislation, as noted, two amendments to the Economic Espionage Act have already been passed. PATSIA is currently pending in Congress, and there's, in fact, two other statutes that have just very recently been presented to the Congress, and I'll address those momentarily. And as far as the fifth prong, promotion of public awareness, the government intends to conduct education and outreach through resources like the Department of Commerce's StopFakes.gov website. And the USPTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, will also provide trainings regarding protection of confidential and trade secret information, and the FBI will continue its current outreach programs in that respect. So what are the implications of this five-point plan? Well, as a result of the plan, there's certainly an increased focus on trade secrets theft in the Department of Justice. PATSIA could be pushed along because of this increased focus, and perhaps there could be even more prosecutions under the Economic Espionage Act. I mentioned that two other bills were recently presented to Congress, and the first is called the Deter Cyber Theft Act. And this is proposed federal legislation to combat cyber espionage and theft of trade secrets and confidential data, and to stop companies from profiting from such conduct. And specifically, it's intended to combat what NSA head and U.S. Cyber Command General Keith Alexander recently called the greatest transfer of wealth in history. And that has to do with all of the alleged thefts out of China, Russia, and elsewhere, and also, frankly, domestically. And what this statute would do is that it would create a registry of stolen technology, and it would also provide for punitive damages against foreign firms attempting to sell products that make use of this stolen technology. Specifically, it would require the Director of the National Intelligence to provide annual reports regarding trade secrets theft, as well as to identify countries and individuals involved in cyber espionage. And this list would include things such as worst offenders, particular technologies targeted by espionage, and the countries and companies, including state-owned firms, that benefit from this type of cyber espionage and theft of trade secrets. Also, the act would require the president to block any imports that involve the use of stolen American technology or that are made by state-owned enterprises or nations on the priority watch list that are similar to items identified as being made using stolen technology. The other statute that's currently working through Congress and was very recently presented is called Aaron's Law Act of 2013. And this is a proposed amendment to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And it's named for Aaron Schwartz, who you may recall is the internet activist who committed suicide in the midst of being prosecuted for allegedly violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And Aaron's Law would amend the CFAA to adopt a narrow interpretation of the law that, frankly, some circuits have already adopted. And in particular, it would change the phrase exceeds authorized access in Section 1030E6 of the CFAA to access without authorization. And this may seem like a small change, but the implication is quite big, as you'll see in a moment. And this new definition would be a three-part test. It would be obtaining information on a protected computer that the accessor lacks authority to obtain, and by knowingly circumventing one or more technological or physical measures that are designed to exclude or prevent unauthorized individuals from obtaining that information. According to the drafters of the bill, Aaron's Law is intended to do several things. First, it's intended to establish that a mere breach of terms of service, employment agreements, or contracts are not automatic violations of the CFAA. Of course, they would still be violations or breaches of those contracts and could be alleged in state court, but you're not necessarily going to have that federal hook anymore to get into federal court. The act would also bring balance back to the CFAA by eliminating a redundant provision of the law that can subject an individual to duplicate charges for the same violation. Aaron Schwartz was faced with this problem. He was charged under various sections of the CFAA for the same conduct. And it would also bring greater proportionality to CFAA penalties. As I noted, several courts in various jurisdictions have already interpreted the CFAA in this or in a similarly narrow manner, and this law would bring more consistency nationwide. In effect, it would make it much more difficult to allege a CFAA claim, and if Patsy is not claimed, that would keep you out of that would ostensibly keep you out of federal court. Finally, we've talked in the past about states that have adopted or are considering adopting the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. Texas this year became the 48th state to adopt it, and that's depending on how you characterize North Carolina's non-compete statute, which effectively is a variation of the Trade Secrets Act, although some might say this is the 47th state to have adopted it. It takes effect on September 1st, 2013, and changes include the ability to collect attorney's fees, a presumption in favor of granting protective orders to preserve secrecy of trade secrets, which is not always the case and is often a barrier to bringing these types of claims. And it also defines trade secrets to include customer lists. So the only remaining states that have not yet adopted the Uniform Trade Secrets Act are Massachusetts and New York. And in fact, Massachusetts could potentially be the next state to adopt the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, although I wouldn't hold my breath. This year, the legislature proposed a bill that would adopt the Uniform Trade Secrets Act and would make certain changes to the law. It would protect all types of confidential business information that has been reasonable efforts have been taken to conceal its details, and it would provide for both injunctive and monetary remedies. Unfortunately, if the pace of the non-compete statute that Dan talked about earlier is any indication, this won't necessarily be passed this year or even in the near future. Things seem to move a little bit slowly up here. And now Bob Stevens will be presenting on social media legislative updates.
Thank you very much, Eric. Appreciate that. And before I get started, let me go ahead and read the CLE credit. To receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you early next week. The code is SS1872. Again, the code for CLE credit is SS1872. I'd also like to note that all of the slides from today's presentation will also be emailed around to the attendees by the end of this week. So you'll have that available to the extent we've had to go through these things fairly quickly because there is a lot to cover. And what I want to do in talking about social media is, first of all, kind of remind some folks who may have attended, but we did a presentation on March the 19th on employee privacy and social networking. Can your trade secrets survive? That was also part of our webinar, Trade Secrets 2013 series. And if you'd like to listen to that, it is available on our blog at www.tradesecretslaw.com. It's March 19, 2013, and that will go into to detail social media and the laws that were in effect prior to March 19, 2013. So kind of what we want to do today is focus on what has happened since then and bring you kind of up to date since March 19th. A couple of quick things, just some quick facts about social media, which you can see on your screen and probably come as no surprise to the audience today. Social media is here to stay, and the world gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And employers are stuck with how to balance their privacy rights of their employees against trying to protect their assets, and particularly their trade secrets, and also do other things such as investigate employee claims such as harassment and things of that nature. You know, indeed, as people have seen in the news, balancing privacy rights is not unique to employers. You know, the NSA, the government, is currently struggling with that issue right now and try to protect the U.S. from terrorists versus balancing privacy rights as they go out and collect cell phone and internet data that some folks said it shouldn't be collecting. So it's not a unique thing for employers, but certainly it's a struggle for employers, and states are consistently making it more difficult at how you go about managing your social media and your employees. So a couple things here talking about social media in the business world before we jump into the laws that have changed. But social media continues to be ubiquitous in marketing and in just in the entire business world. And then who owns those social media accounts is particularly troubling and difficult to ascertain at times. You know, for example, if an employee has a list of customers that they're dealing with and they have them on a Facebook page, or there's a company Facebook page that an employee is in charge of managing, there can be questions about who owns that particular social media page and whether or not they can take it with them or you can have access to it. And as I plug through here on the screen, you know, employers got to think about, you know, why do they worry about social media? And I think it's because it's part of the fabric of the business today. And earlier people mentioned about trade secrets, and as most people on the seminar today now know, trade secrets can be easily taken away and moved around through electronic means, particularly through social media. And it's not always clear who has ownership of a list of friends or have ownership of social media. And so to kind of bring you up to date on where we are with the laws, the legislative update, there are currently 36 states that have enacted or proposed some form of social media privacy laws. And the expansion throughout the states is very rapid. Just less than a year ago, as you can see on your screen, California passed legislation dealing with social media. And that was in September of 2012. And within the last week, Nevada just passed one, and they became the 11th state to pass legislation dealing with social media. And as you can see from your screen, there are another 25 or so that likewise are exploring social media laws. You can see from the screen, too, there's currently no national legislation on social media. The odds are that it will eventually pass, but it will take some time and not anytime soon before there is a national law dealing with how employers deal with social media accounts and their employees. But just since March the 19th, these six states have passed laws dealing with social media. Nevada, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Arkansas, and Utah. And it's more of kind of like a patchwork quilt, if you will, as to what the laws are. There are some things that are very consistent. They deal with who has ownership of login accounts. Who has the right? Does an employer have the right to ask its employees for login information to their accounts, to see their accounts, to be friended on an account? What happens if you inadvertently obtain ownership or obtain access to it? Things of that nature. The social media, the remedies, the ownership, the exceptions all vary from state to state. And so right now, employers are stuck with dealing with kind of a patchwork quilt of laws that is very quickly expanding. And they need to be, as much as they can, cognizant of the changing laws and how they evaluate their social media policies in dealing with employees. Let me talk briefly about these states and their laws. The first one is Nevada, and what I've done is I've done it in reverse order. Nevada just passed their law within the last week, 10 days, and it goes into effect very shortly, October 1, 2013. And as you can see from the list there, just like most states that have passed laws, it makes it illegal for an employer to require, request, or suggest an employee or applicant disclose username, password, or other access information to social media accounts. So it also talks about taking adverse actions against employees who refuse to provide such information. However, there are exceptions, as with some of the others. For example, if you're conducting an investigation in Nevada, you will have the right to ask in certain situations for information, content information, not the actual login information. But Nevada, unlike some of the other states, has a very broad definition of social media, which includes email accounts. Some of the states who have passed laws, their social media definition doesn't include email accounts. And as you'll see here in just a minute, they don't define what's personal, because really what's at issue here is protecting the employee's privacy and their personal accounts. So you'll see in Oregon, which passed a law in May 22nd, which will take effect next year, it is a similar deal that it prohibits employers from requiring employees and applicants to relinquish account logins or give employer access to social media accounts. And it prohibits retaliation. This talks briefly kind of about what the damages are under Oregon's law. But let me jump to the next page on Oregon. It talks about a couple of exceptions that appear in a lot of the state's law. And I'm not going to go through all of these. But if you jump down, for example, to employers not liable for innocent discovery, not every state's law has this, but most states' laws do. And what this means is, and for example, if the employer were to innocently discover login information, credentials, usernames of one of its employees as part of an investigation or as part of monitoring its own networks, it is not in violation of the law, even though it has obtained the login information. Obviously, they can't use it. And what is unique about Oregon, and I'll talk briefly about Washington too, is that neither of those two states adequately define what a personal account is. So, for example, if an employee is using an account for business and for his personal life, is that a personal account or is that a business account? You know, at this, given the evolving law, obviously the this stage, the better course of action is to be conservative and treat it as a personal account. However, there are some steps employers can take to try to protect themselves, such as enter into ownership agreements with employees. For example, if you have employees who manage your, the company's social media accounts, their Facebook page or their Twitter account, have an agreement with that employee that they understand that login information is the company's. The company owns that account, and therefore, if it gets changed, the company can request and require that login information because it is the company's and not the person who the company has employed to manage that account for them. Some other steps that could be taken to add some protection as the case law evolves would be to put into job descriptions that employees are required to create or maintain, say, a LinkedIn page for customers or contacts, and that the employer will help them set that up. While ultimately it's unclear as to whether or not that would be personal or the companies, it would give the companies some protection in the event they obtained access to that account. Washington, very similar to Oregon, May 21 is when that was passed, and it goes into effect very shortly here in less than a month or right at a month. And briefly, it talks about, we say there, and it strikes a balance, the original Washington law was very broad and had no protection for good faith employer investigations. Most states' laws that have passed thus far allow states, or employers, excuse me, to conduct investigations into things such as harassment in the workplace, and as part of that, can obtain content information from accounts and require employees to provide content information. Still, most of the states do not allow you to obtain the login information even as part of an investigation, or their username, but you can get the content from them. So Washington did bring in some of those exceptions that provide some protection to employers. And those are mentioned here on the bottom of page two of the Washington piece. They can request the content information. It also created the innocent discovery rule that's in most states' laws. As I mentioned before, if a employer innocently discovers login information through monitoring its network, for example, it does not run afoul of the law in doing so. Real quick here, as I try to keep us close to the time, Colorado, they likewise passed a law, and it actually goes into effect on Monday. As with all the other laws that have passed, it prohibits employers from requiring employee or applicants to disclose login information to personal accounts, and you cannot retaliate. It does provide some exceptions regarding investigation. And Colorado, a little bit different than some of the other states, it does provide some protection regarding financial institutions that are not covered by all the other states. Arkansas, I'll briefly touch on when it was passed April 22nd. It has similar stuff. You know, I think it's important on this one to mention bullet point 3, where it talks about, it provides some additional description that other states' laws do not, but as we work our way through what I call a patchwork quilt of laws, I think ultimately we'll have some consistency in them. Right now, there's a lot of inconsistencies with respect to definitions and ultimately how the innocent discovery rule and personal account in these states are going to be interpreted. But you'll see there that this law specifically says that accounts opened by employees at the employer's request. For example, if an employer requests or requires employees to have a LinkedIn account, that would be accepted from this law, or accounts provided to the employee by the employer. The employer itself sets up a LinkedIn account, as an example, could help them do that. Account set up on behalf of the employer, once again, if the employer has a Twitter page or a Facebook page that it set up, but it has an employee, maybe in its marketing department or its IT department, that manages that account, they obviously would have login information, but that would be the employer's login information and not that of the employee. And so the employee, you could require the employee to provide that information to you since it is the employer's account. And finally, amongst laws that have passed since March 19th, when we did the more detailed social media presentation, is in Utah. And this went into effect on May the 14th. I provide just a couple of additional examples here where it talks about penalties. Once again, the penalties, like the other remedies and things I mentioned before, exceptions, kind of run the gamut. They're not consistent in each state. Some states, penalties can be very, very small. In other states, they get larger. And once again, as the laws kind of come into effect, we'll be able to see kind of more consistency and help provide advice with respect to employers in drafting policies to protect their trade secrets from social media and theft in that regard. So that was, I know, very, very quick in running through the laws of social media, but we do appreciate your time. And as I mentioned before, we're going to send out the CLE acknowledgement form shortly, within the week. We'll also send out the webinar PowerPoint presentation via email so that you'll have that and if you want to look at it without having being rushed through it. I also want to mention today, while we still have you, that our next presentation in the series will be in the month of July. We do not have a date set yet, but it will be published on our blog, and we'll be sending out notices of that. It's entitled, How Big Data Impacts Trade Secret, Computer Fraud, and Privacy Law. And that will be the seventh in our Trade Seekers 2013 webinar series. And with that, we want to thank you for participating today, and we'll be signing off. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes today's web conference. You may now disconnect.